Being in the UK, it's a different dynamic because we're quite two-dimensional, where it's like, you're allowed to do one thing and one thing only, and then you move on to the next thing. Whereas in America, it's very much like, be who you want to be. Yeah, you know, there's opportunities everywhere.
Hey everyone, I'm Katie Trexton, and you are listening to Anatomy of an Agency, the podcast that lifts the lid on everything that goes on behind the scenes of the talent industry. In this episode, we are talking to Maria Idrissi, the world's first hijabi model when she featured in H&M's global Close the Loop campaign. I started by asking her when her journey with agents began.
My one was immediately after I got scouted. And that was just because I had no idea what to do next. My manager at the time, because I was working in a children's shop, and I had people coming in saying, can I take a photo? Because they saw me in a campaign. And she was like, Maria, I didn't know how to say this, but I think it's maybe time to leave the nest. And I was like, oh, but if I leave my job, I'm like, how do I make money? And I guess the logical thing was, well, I'll get an agent and they should be able to get me money. And it actually worked at that time. So that was, yeah, that's how it started.
How did you choose your agent?
I feel like we came together. It was a mutual thing. So actually it was a friend of a friend who introduced me to Joe, who does PR. And even though he wasn't necessarily a talent agent, because he did PR and that's what I needed at the time, I was just going to events and then networking. And if someone wanted to work with me, I'd be like, hey, Joe, do you want to negotiate the deal? And then that worked for a while. Then after that, my friend actually became my... Listen, I've had so many agents.
Oh, it must be great relationships.
Yeah. I could write a book on, like, I don't know, like being an expert in finding an agent and when to leave as well. But I've got really great relationships with everyone, which is good. Never burn bridges. So yeah, I got my friend. That was actually such a fun time because she wasn't an agent either. I just thought, oh, well, I'm not an model, really. You know, you're not an agent. This will be fun. And that worked as well, really well, for about a year. And then she was like, Maria, I think it's time I leave the nest now because this isn't my life purpose to be a talent agent. And then that's when I moved on to the next one. So, yeah.
But one of the things that's interesting is the story that you kind of referenced at the start, after you were scouted, made you the world's first hijabi model. Was it easy for you to feel, obviously slightly different if it was your friend, but when you were finding agents where that was their career and they had a roster of talent, was it easy for you to feel that they were taking you on because they really believed in you and they understood you? Or did you ever feel there was a risk, maybe even with people you didn't choose, that they wanted to work with you for tokenistic reasons?
It's interesting, but maybe because I'm not very sensitive in the sense of I don't get offended easily. So I could read through whether this is like a tokenistic thing, but of course we all want to make money and they also like me as a person. And I was like, yeah, a bit of tokenism, whatever. I was like, we'll make it. I think at the time it was really stressful being young, you know, at that age where it's like everyone else is getting their careers, finished uni. I'd finished uni and I was kind of unemployed / self-employed. I didn't really know how to figure it out. So my focus is really, I need to just make money because everyone's seeing me on TV doing all these great things, traveling, but I don't have this consistent income and I can't necessarily do it on my own because it was like unprofessional. So even if there was all these side things that came with it, I'm like, well, you're nice, you know, I'm cool, so whatever. And I think that's sometimes how it is in the beginning. You know, it's like when someone applies for a job and they're making cups of teas and stuff and they don't necessarily enjoy it, but they understand this is just the process. And the more experience you have, the longer you've been in that space, then you can start being a bit more picky. But you obviously set boundaries. I'm not going to be like, accept disrespect or anything, you know, that crosses boundaries. But yeah, it wasn't too bad.
Well, and you're still building together, you're still building your profile and your profile still represents you and that still made you a visible role model as well as a model for so many people out there. But how do you, because I know that you are about so much more than your modeling, although the modeling side, everybody loves everything you do in the modeling sphere, but how do you diversify? Because I think it can be quite easy if someone takes you on as a model to be like, no, that's what you are. If you now want to go into something else, you're as good as starting again.
Yeah, pretty much. The advantage I have is knowing where to go, in the sense of, because I've met so many different people in this space, it's not like completely starting from scratch, moving into film. But then in terms of, in a way, proving that I can do this job, that does feel new, because everyone recognizes me for fashion. But the interesting thing is, my background prior to fashion was film. It was writing. That's what I studied to do. And maybe it just takes conversations. But also being in the UK, it's a different dynamic, because we're quite two-dimensional, where it's like, you're allowed to do one thing and one thing only, and then you move on to the next thing. Whereas in America, it's very much like, be where you want to be. Yeah, you know, there's opportunities everywhere. And you have to be really adaptable to where you are. So with the UK, I guess the way I try to do it tactfully is say, okay, I want to make films. You guys know me for fashion. Let's do something around fashion. And then it comes away from me being this film director or something to, oh, I'm a talent that's going to tell my story in fashion, and I'm just going to have creative control over it.
You've said before that, as well as knowing how to find the right agent, you know when to leave the right agent. Is that because...
Awkward. No, don't. No.
Is that because you're Madonna and you keep deciding to reinvent yourself? Or is that because eventually you're like, you know what, I'm going to quit while we're ahead.
No, you know, me and Madonna actually have the same birthday, funny enough.
There you go.
No, do you know what? I think it's more so, yeah, a part of me reinventing myself and then examining if where I'm at can also facilitate the other things that I want to do. And if it can't, it's never anything personal. It's more like, oh, I want to do these other things, which is probably why I have, even now, I have a couple managers. It's not just, it's very rarely it's just one, because I do so many different things. And so I just like to compartmentalize things rather than saying, you're one person and I do this many things and you need to be able to do everything for me, because it's unfair. And I think it also eases the load off the people I work with. There's not so much pressure that, oh my God, I've got this talent and she's great and, you know, she wants to do all these things and I'm only strong in these areas. So yeah, that's usually why.
Have you ever felt deprioritized versus other people on someone's books?
Yes.
Was that a marker of time to go, or was that a marker of, well, no, maybe I don't have a profile as high as whoever's getting prioritized, and actually maybe there's a slipstream here?
It's a bit of, but so my markers are usually if I don't feel prioritized, then they can stay whilst I find someone that will prioritize me. And if we all work harmoniously together, great. And if we don't, then obviously it's, yeah, time to go.
So in terms of your next chapter, you're going to be working in multiple different countries. How are you planning on navigating that in terms of representation, the different ways things work in different countries, the different even cultures you're going to be spanning?
So between the UK and the UAE, so Dubai specifically. Well, Dubai I'm really familiar with. I've been going so often for so many years, so I've already built, you know, my own circles there of friends and work and everything. So at one point as well, I was getting more work in that region than I was in the UK before COVID. So now, because everyone's left, it does feel like starting over again. But yeah, I think it's just another adventure. I clearly like to go down the path not taken all the time. Even though people do work between different countries. Growing up and looking back, I realized, as much as I tell myself, oh, I wanna have a simple life, and I do, I also realize at the same time that
your definition of simplicity and other people's is
maybe different. Yeah, I'm doing like what? Because you can either stay in a place and then struggle if you feel like you're struggling in that place, and then hope that it will change. What's that saying? You know, you can keep doing the same thing expecting different result.
That's insanity.
Yeah. So I look at that as more complicated. Mm-hmm. Trying to get some miraculous way of changing it, the situation you're in. Or you can just try to change it yourself. So, and that for me is a more simple solution.
Well, yeah, get on the front foot, be proactive. We were talking about tokenism. But one of the interesting things that I find working in diversity is that actually, despite the fact that people now, thank goodness, want to look for people who are different, they actually want people who are different who then fit within a box they've decided is the right form of different, right? Mm-hmm. So if you are a model who wears hijab, you should be from Africa, or you should have heritage from Asia, mm-hmm. and you should represent this culture or that culture. And actually, when you turn up as you do, half Pakistani, half Moroccan, from the UK, and you have this blended identity, a lot of people go, oh, I don't know where that, maybe that's too different.
Yeah.
How do you kind of navigate the fact that you're like, oh my goodness, one minute you're saying you want different and now you're saying it's not the right kind of different?
Yeah, I've learned now that rather than trying to define myself, I just say, look, I'm a creative person and I have projects, because I think it's a lot easier in this day of age when we're so overwhelmed with so much going on to try to fit yourself into a place when you know you do multiple things, you represent different things. And in a way that actually simplifies it for people by saying like, yeah, you're not gonna be able to fit me anywhere, but that's the cool thing. I'm like this hybrid species and I can do these multiple things, but the umbrella it fits under is being creative. It's being very colorful, both in my background, both in what I do. And then it's like, okay, let's, that word, colorful, we'll just, that's who you are now, because everyone just wants this, I don't know, there's this picture of how to define someone. So yeah, that's. I mean, I just embrace now the fact that my work is always going to be different branches, but it comes under this one mission that I have.
I feel like we can't do the podcast without talking about faith. I think it's very easy for a modern agent nowadays to look at someone with ostensible signs of their religion and be like, okay, I understand that it's modest fashion, it's whatever. But actually, I know for you, it goes far deeper than that. It's not a question of, well, as long as I'm dressed modestly, then I can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Because it actually goes down to your core. But that can be a challenge in terms of accepting all commercial opportunities or potentially even clashing with somebody representing you who doesn't share that faith. Yeah. How do you navigate that?
Yeah, that's like the setting the boundaries about the things around the things that you will and won't do, just knowing very clearly from early on, this is who I am, this is what I want to do, and anything that doesn't complement it or clashes with it, it's just not for me. And it's, you know, I think when you represent yourself that way as well, people tend to know, like, oh yeah, we won't ask her to do an alcohol ad, you know, there's a bit of or a gambling thing, you know, so there's a bit of common sense that plays into it, but that has to start from within you. If you're really clear about what you represent, people are going to know, you know.
But what's interesting is, because you have quite a lot of Instagram followers and you've been able to monetize that, but actually you were reasonably grown up by the time that became something. I can see a world where social media is so pervasive in everybody's lives now, you can easily be starting to build your brand online before you know who you are, before you know what your boundaries are, before you know what compromises you're prepared to make, and where any opportunity feels like an open door. Unfortunately, your first opportunity was quite a big one. Put you in 100 and how many countries?
149 countries, a lot, something like that, yeah.
And it's very difficult to row back once you've made your mark on the world in that public way. Do you have any advice for young people, probably also in this instance, young Muslim women who are trying to make their mark, but it's just so risky, everything you say and do?
Definitely. I mean, even around the time I was scouted, I was 23, and even though I had been wearing hijab for like a few years, because I didn't come from a household where, you know, the hijab was encouraged upon me. Of course, people appreciated it that I started wearing it, but it wasn't something that I had to do. And so if I ever wanted to just, don't feel like wearing it or going on holiday, I felt always free to make that choice. I did it. I never did, but I knew in the back of my mind if I wanted to, I could. But after that campaign, it's like, well, can't take this off now, can I? That's it, because that's what I was recognized for. And some people could see that as, oh my God, it's pressure, it feels suffocating. But for me, I looked at it as, well, I started wearing it because I wanted to wear it, to be closer to my faith and God. So it was more of, it was like encouragement. It was like, yes, now this has happened. I'm almost like bound to it in a good way, because I wanted to be. Yeah, it's how you look at it. It's what you want. And that is tricky, because I guess some people, you know, some people don't figure out what the things they want until a lot later in life. And we still learn, of course. It's a forever learning process. But I do think there are fundamentals. If you're going to make the choice, like I didn't make the choice to be scouted, and I didn't expect that to kick off the way it was. I was just told I'm going to be an extra in an advert. I was like, yeah, I've been an extra before in a couple of things in the past. Nothing came off it.
I am the advert.
I thought that's what I thought. And I don't even think that was the plan. I genuinely think I was supposed to be an extra, but then somehow, anyway. So because it happened by accident, I was literally like catapulted into the middle of the sea, and I was like, swim, swim. But if you're consciously making that choice, you know, to start videos, I mean, no one's putting a gun to your head to start doing videos and trying to get them to go viral. So that means, ideally, you would be more prepared for what could come of it, rather than saying afterwards, oh, I wasn't ready, or I didn't know.
I know that there's a world and there are opportunities that you've actually missed out on, because sometimes for agents or for producers or whoever else, casting directors, it's actually easier to choose someone who isn't a hijabi to wear hijab in a TV series or a public context, because they have flexibility. Mm. Than it is to work with someone who actually leads their daily life wearing hijab. Do you see a world and a time where that will change?
I think AI is going to change it for everyone. They'll be like, we don't need any of you. We'll just make a hijabi. It would be nice, because hijab is obviously tied to religion, so it's a lot more of a sensitive area. Then it is just something else. So I think there are definitely important areas of why it's good to hire someone that wears hijab. But then I also understand, on the other side, if the storyline is focused on someone that wears a hijab and there's scenes or whatever where it's not, it wouldn't be natural for her to wear it, that can also be counterproductive, because if people already have this misconception, we wear it in the shower and all sorts of things, depicting that because, oh, she's an actress, she can't take it off, won't help. So I can understand why in some cases it's like, well, she's at home in this film. Hijabis don't wear the hijab at home if no one's around. So it's like, it's tricky, because I can see it from both an actor's perspective of, hey, we should be representing ourselves. And I see it also from a director's perspective of, well, this isn't helping my script, it's hindering it.
But I think it's just interesting in a world where, you know, there's been a lot of debates, haven't there, around people who are transgender should only be playing transgender characters. And obviously, historically, people would even use makeup to try and change the colour of their skin to play different roles. And now we look at those things and we go, oh my goodness, like, that would be crazy. Outrageous. Imagine doing that. So I was just kind of interested to know whether you thought that there was a world in which we went in the same direction and would yield so many more opportunities for hijabis, or whether, you know, as you say, sometimes it can be creatively challenging.
Yeah, because I, especially writing now, I can understand the challenge if, again, you need to show her in a scene where she's not necessarily wearing it for the storyline. But I also think that should pose a positive creative challenge, so that you can do it where you can imagine that she's not wearing it. So I did an advert with a brand once, and it was supposed to be like a nighttime routine, and obviously I don't sleep in my hijab. So at the end it was like, they didn't think that, oh, I'm not going to switch off the light and pretend good night whilst I'm wearing the hijab. So I said, we should work it in a way where the camera kind of, you know, where it shows that I'm taking it off, and then it kind of fades into this thing, you see my hand switch off the light, rather than you have to visually...
You lie down.
Yeah. Watch me getting into bed. Like, it's unnecessary. And it worked. That's what they use that suggestion. So I think in film as well, there are ways. I mean, there's so many films and series in, you know, the Middle East where it's like, it's still to be, we're not going to have sex scenes and stuff, but then the character gets pregnant. So we don't need to watch the making of the child to know that, oh, it happened. So I think we can apply that same mentality with the hijab as well, in that sense, you know.
So I guess the lesson there is, it can't always be avoided, but people should maybe stop and think and see if there is another way before they just take the easy way out.
Exactly. Use that creative genius in you. You know, if you've got that opportunity to be directing something or writing something, then think of a way where we can keep it really authentic by getting someone who wears a hijab for real, and then just try to avoid showing her ever taking it off.
That's great advice there from Maria. Don't look for the quick wins and build for the long term. Now it is time for Legal Corner, brought to you by our partners Hugh James. This time we are speaking to Rhiannon Dale, partner in employment and HR at Hugh James. Our chat with Maria inspired us to want to find out what exactly the legalities are around what is and isn't discrimination. So we asked Rhiannon that very question.
It's an interesting question because people often talk about discrimination and, you know, they feel that they've been discriminated against. But in law, it's important to remember that really the protection only applies if it is discrimination on the grounds of a protected characteristic. So under the Equality Act, we have 9 of them. We have age, sex, sexual orientation, disability, race, religion or belief, gender reassignment, marriage or civil partnership, or pregnancy and maternity.
That was very impressive.
Thank you. Some finger counting going on. But yes, it's only really if the discrimination relates to one of those 9 protected characteristics that you have that legal protection. Now, of course, you can feel hard done by and you can raise other issues with that. But the legal protection only kicks in if it relates to one of those specific things. So I think that's the first point that's really important to remember. The next point is that, is it actually a type of discrimination? So again, we have different types of discrimination protected by the Equality Act. We have direct discrimination. So for example, where somebody is treated less favourably because of that characteristic. So if somebody is not selected for a team, for example, purely because of the colour of their skin, then clearly that is direct discrimination. But we also have more nuanced forms, and in particular indirect discrimination. So that is where there is a rule, a provision, a policy that's applied equally to everyone, but it impacts on a particular group of people who share that common characteristic more, and it has a disproportionate effect or disadvantage to them. So for example, if there's a requirement to wear a particular kit, that could have a disproportionate effect on a particular religion, for example, that requires you to wear a certain dress, for example, and that might make wearing that kit more difficult. So that's an example of where something is applied equally to everyone, but it can affect you more individually or collectively because of this common characteristic.
And what would your advice be, you know, for the people who are thinking, well, I am pretty sure, I'm not a lawyer, but I'm pretty sure I'm getting discriminated against, but I either don't want to make a fuss, or I've heard people say that if I do kick up a fuss, then there's almost like a doubling of the discrimination because I will have further repercussions. Like, what should they do?
Well, first of all, I'd say always raise a complaint with your club, with the organisation, who you think is responsible for managing that system where you feel you've suffered discrimination. That may be a governing body, it could be an individual organisation, but absolutely, you should always raise these concerns. And also you should note that you are protected if you do raise a concern. So another form of discrimination is something called victimisation. So if you have done a protected act, that is to complain about an act of discrimination, or if you have supported somebody else in their complaint of discrimination, then that does also afford you specific protection under the Equality Act. And also, I do think there is an increased focus on EDI more generally in sport. So I do think that culture is changing and these complaints are taken much more seriously than perhaps they used to be.
Okay, I am so much better informed now. Thank you so much to Rhiannon for joining us. And thank you also to Maria Idrissi. But you know who else we want to hear from? We want to hear from you. So please get in touch on social media at Good Vibes Only Talent or email us. gvo@goodvibesonlytalent.com. And other than that, for now, from me, it is goodbye.